Alrighty, welcome to Real Asian Podcast. I am Ray Liu, joined today with Saba and Renee. What's up, y'all? How y'all doing?
Hey!
Nice to see you too.
Yes, in the spirit of turning red, I've turned pink, so here we go.
Yeah, you got your whole... I've said this probably in previous episodes too. I think every time you do, I do a pod with you, your hair is a different color.
It's true.
That's the best. I love that.
Sorry, does it depend on the movie that we're doing, the episode, or is it a mood ring kind of deal?
Yes, exactly. It's a very throwback to 90s.
So today we are talking about Disney Pixar's Turning Red, a film written and directed by Domi Shi. If you recognize the name, Domi Shi wrote and directed the animated short Bao, which was shown before the Incredibles 2 premiere. Turning Red takes place in Toronto, Canada during the early 2000s, centered around a 13-year-old Chinese-Canadian girl named Mei Li. Under the intense, watchful care of her mother, Ming, Mei and her three close friends hope to attend the concert of their favorite boy band, 4Town. During this quest, Mei's emotions for boys run rampant, so much so that it turns her into a big, furry red panda every time she gets overly excited. Mei learns that the transformation of the red panda is something that has been passed down to the women in her family, dating all the way back to her ancestors. However, there is a ritual that is able to suppress the red panda. Unfortunately, the night of the ritual is the same night as a concert, to which Mei ultimately decides to keep her panda, skip the ritual, and attend the concert against her mother's will. After a battle about Mei's independence in the form of panda-on-panda action, Mei and Ming ultimately find understanding between the two, where Mei balances her time with family and friends. So, Saba, I'm going to look to you. What's your big take from this movie?
Well, I love the movie, so my big takeaway is related to why I loved it. And, you know, even though the film is actually set, like, maybe in the early 2000s, when I first watched it, it felt like it was like the late 90s. Like in my mind, it was 1994 with the Tamagotchis and all that stuff. And so my big takeaway is it really felt to me like this movie is like the anthem of second generation Asian American daughters in the 90s, you know? And it had this interesting message about staying true to yourself in order to more happily belong to community. And I think it still rings true today, but really speaks to this interesting engagement between how to be yourself, how to be an individual in this space that values collective, especially at a time when I think the model minority myth was really dominant in culture. And so for me, it kind of felt like a window into that conversation through a young woman who's learning about herself.
Renee, what are your thoughts?
I want to take a moment and actually ask, can we define what is second generation? Because I know there's like, I know what the academic version of it is, but I want to level set with also our audience.
The street version.
Right. What's this?
You want the street version. What they say in the streets.
When I say second generation, I mean like Mei Ling's parents appear to have immigrants, and she appears to be more rooted in this culture. At least that was the sense that I got watching that. So I consider her like second generation American for that reason. Although maybe that's first generation, you know, maybe it's one and a half. I'm not really sure.
No, that's actually a really good conversation piece because that's the reason why I wanted to bring it up. So for me, for an example, my parents and my grandparents, but they came here during like right after the Vietnam War. And so I consider them like 1.5. That would make me 2. But then what I like to say is I consider it first generation born. Yeah. Mm. So I do like to refer to myself as first generation born in the US, but yeah, I am technically second generation because I was born here. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
I see myself the same way. If I were to phrase it as first generation born or second generation American.
Right. How about you, Ray? How do you see it?
I've always thought of myself as first generation. I guess if I was to steal your definition, Renee, it's like, yes, I'm first generation born here because I'm the first, me, my other cousins and sister were first born here in America when my mom and dad left Vietnam. I hear different definitions of it.
Right.
Like, my thing is that I've heard the definition to where I'm second generation and my parents are first generation when they immigrated here. So they're the first generation Americans because they immigrated here. And then I'm the second generation, but I'm born here kind of thing. But then I also wonder, what does that make my grandparents then? Are they zero generation or does it cut off? Like, just because my parents immigrated to America? That's the only thing where I've always been confused about. But in this case, though, Saba, in this case, we're assuming if Ming's grandmother, Ming's mom, which is Mei Ling's grandmother, she's the one who immigrated to Toronto, and then Ming lived in Canada, so she's first generation, and that would make Mei second generation. Is that what we're assuming here?
Actually, no. I think it's the one where she second generation, meaning that She's the person who was like first born here.
I gotcha.
That was my understanding. I wasn't entirely certain, but the way the dynamics worked out, and I think it is interesting to look at how those generations work, because sometimes it's like a couple who will come here and then will bring their parents and then will have children here. So it's an interesting kind of dynamic, or bring their siblings here or something like that as well.
Right.
I got the feeling when I was watching it, and now I realize this may be a little unsubstantiated, but I did watch the movie a couple of times, and this was just the impression that stuck to me, was that that perhaps Mei Ling was born in Toronto or in Canada. Her parents had emigrated there, and that, you know, that left her. So I considered her parents to be first generation Canadians, right? And then Mei Ling to be second generation. But it could be that could be totally wrong. I'm willing to like be wrong on that.
So from my understanding, the temple has been there for a really long time. So like maybe a century or something like that, because it's one of the oldest. So then it leaves me with the impression that actually they immigrated much earlier, in the early 1900s kind of thing.
They might be many generations in, actually. Wow. Okay.
Which is, this is important, but I wanted to ask y'all too, how would that somewhat give nuance to the lived experiences between Mei, Ming, and the grandma in this context of Turning Red?
Right. I think one of the biggest ones is like the modernity of it, right? I think, for an example, Ming is like someone who's kind of still tied to more tradition, where Mei Lin has a opportunity to actually assimilate more into, you know, the modern culture and things like that. And so
modern Canadian culture.
Right. So, you know, I think but there is that aspect of that multi-generational or intergenerational, like, you know, generational kind of like trauma and the expectations,
ding.
You know, old school.
That's the buzzword right there.
Yeah.
And the relationship to tradition that we see as well, because I think like, you know, Mei Ling seems to me like she honors her tradition, but is also like looking for a strong sense of individuality, and the relationship between you know, her grandmother and tradition seems a lot stronger, because during the ceremony, there's even the conversation about how she prefers the traditional rather than
she's OG.
Right.
So funny. You know what's so funny though is like for the longest time, whenever someone said OG, they don't mean older generation. They actually mean like original gangster.
Yes.
Yeah. So in the 90s, I was always like, wait, which OG do you mean by OG? Grandpa's OG? The hell? He was a gangster when he came? And it's possible.
I always thought it was original gangster. I didn't realize it could also mean older generation. I guess that makes sense as well.
All right. I'm glad that we're all 90s babies at the very minimum. Not babies, but you know, like 90s kids. So like, you know.
Renee, what are your thoughts on Saba's big take though?
I absolutely think Saba hit it right on the head, you know, like I there's like plus one to pretty much everything that Saba said, because this is a really great kind of stepping stone to have those conversations about what does it mean to all these different nuances and how we honor our elders and how we seek that individuality of being able to still be able to be ourselves. And can I just do a quick shout out to Baby Bat Priya? I'm yes. like, oh my God, so happy to see South Asian goth representation. Yes. And we have Sava here, who is our resident goth, you know, as well, goth mom. So wonderful to have you. I'm so happy to be in that same space and share it with you. Yes.
Hashtag goth represent.
And so, yeah, you know, like, it's interesting because you have Miriam, who's definitely white, but then you have Abby, who's, I won't take any shine away from Ray talking about Abby, but who is also Asian as well. Mm-hmm. And Priya, who's South Asian. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like,
Abby is Korean, I think.
Yes, she is. Yes, yes, okay. She is. So, you know, I definitely feel like really connected to this movie. I cried, I sobbed throughout the entire thing. So then
I cried too.
Yes. So then I'm gonna pause because I have this thing with Ray, even from the first season, where I ask Ray every time, Ray, did this movie make you cry?
It's gonna have to be a no in this one.
Okay.
More laugh than cry.
Okay.
Actually, just laugh. Didn't no cry.
No cry.
We're gonna find a movie that makes them appear, that makes them sprout.
Yes, right? That's exactly it. Yeah, exactly. Grow so that he gets a little misty at least. You yes. know, so.
I told Renee this, but Remember the Titans is probably the movie that got closest to me crying.
That's a good one.
That's the one that almost got me.
There you go.
I was like, you're my brother. So I definitely agree with much of your points, Saba. My biggest takeaway I would add, I personally think it's more about Domi's message to young women out there and all growing girls. Because to me, the panda, you know, I think this is a breaking news or anything, but the panda represents womanhood. Mm-hmm. And having May keep her panda at the end was Domi's message to young girls to accept their womanhood in every way it turns out. So, you know, in the plot of the movie, the aunties and the grandma and the mom suppress their red panda in their ambulance. In a way, to me, that says, you know, that's just how they have to keep it under control. And you think about Ming's generation and her mothers and her sisters, they grew up in a society where women were expected to act a certain way, play a certain role. Therefore, they needed to conceal their panda in order to navigate the world that they lived in. But to Domi, I think Domi says, hey, let's have May do the opposite. So I think it asks girls to let their panda go and be themselves and to accept all their strengths and also their flaws.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, I think that makes total sense because, like, you know, we're talking about a specific kind of womanhood in this particular story, and it's one that relates to individuality mm-hmm. and that isn't defined just by the patriarchy. It's not women subjugating their sense of self for what a group or society expects out of them as women. So I totally love that.
Absolutely. And this happens to be one of, like, the first feature film from Pixar that was completely women-led leadership in film development. And you mm-hmm. can really tell. There's the difference between, and this is something in, like, I guess in film in general, when you can tell when the film is created for a men's gaze versus, like, a woman's gaze, right? And I mm-hmm. think that's one of the things to take into consideration about why it's important to have more representation that's diverse, that includes, you know, different genders, to be able to help represent and push the narrative forward. Because when you have different perspectives, you can be able to just tease out things and the nuance of it just a little bit better and really drive that home. So yes, there were quite a few people who felt like this film wasn't made for them. And that's fair, but you don't have to.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think there was quite a few women and young girls who probably did see themselves in this and could be able to relate.
Something that was really interesting to me, Renee, when you said, with this movie written and created through a woman's gaze versus a man's gaze, because I think about how May and her friends are kind of boy crazy. They're kind of going through these like teenage, you know, hormonal stuff that every teenage boy and girl kind of goes through. And I think the people who out there who say, oh, you know, this is the horniest Disney Pixar movie ever. And they're all boy crazy. But I feel like the majority of the people who are saying that are men, because through a man's gaze, it's like, oh, women shouldn't act like that. And girls shouldn't act like that. They shouldn't be so boy crazy. But I think, and you guys tell me, the reality is that when you are growing up around that time, you know, a lot of women out there are boy crazy, right?
I mean, everyone has eyes and feelings, you know?
Exactly. So,
but no, I think it's a fair representation.
Like, it's not, it shouldn't be, like, frowned upon.
Right.
Right.
There is an embrace of female sexuality and the empowerment that comes with it.
Yeah.
And it's never reactive in this movie. You know, the girls are the ones who are projecting their budding desire in interesting ways that are often creative and powerful.
I love that you say that, Saba, because one of the things is that, you know, I was having this online conversation, you know, so don't go into the comment section of things, but I was having, there was this person.
That was your first mistake.
I know, first mistake. But there was this person who said that they were a little bit worried about it because of some of the sexual trauma that they had as a kid. They were worried that some of the, that when they said like women's sexuality, they thought it was going to be something completely different. And what I was able to come in and say was like, you know, I'm a survivor too, but that the way that the girl's sexuality is expressed is not physical in any way. The manifestations of it are like, are in a kind of dreamy way, and there's no touching or things like that, but there is, you know, the discussion around like that budding desire, as you said, Saba, that I think is still, that's okay. It's good to have that kind of conversation, and that kind of, that's not a gray area, but that area that doesn't really get talked about, at least not mainstream. And so, you know, I think that was something that was really well broached, and the easiest way to do it is through boy bands, right? So
yes, well, and then the way those boy bands were depicted in like Mei Ling's Desire, in her doodles, even she depicted them as mermen, and they came out onto the stage as angels. I mean,
merman,
but there's also like technically there's nothing to worry about, you know?
Right, so, exactly.
I mean, there's something innocent about that sort of a way of looking at things that is desirable, that is attractive, that is maybe sensual, but isn't aggressive or isn't risky at all. I mean,
can I just kind of like interject here in regards to, did anyone think the Daisy Mart scene was just a fever dream?
Oh my god, it was wild. Wow.
I was like, what?
That was so humiliating.
Oh my god, I would have just died. That she literally was turning red, you know? And so I really felt like that was the reason why it went over the top, because she was like in the Daisy Mart. She was just turning red all the over, and it was like, "Oh, that's what they mean too." Like blushing and just embarrassment. And I was like, "Oh, okay." Yeah, I thought it was a fever dream until it literally, like, wait a minute. I just had to process it and was like, oh, wait, that really happened.
Right. And it's so interesting to see that that happened, because this conversation between women and their mothers and the women of their lineage, that's part of that conversation there, because women, as they're learning how to embrace desire, how to embrace womanhood and self-empowerment, are often indoctrinated with a lot of toxic shame about these kinds of things. Mm. And that's that moment where she is totally humiliated, and there's all this shame surrounding what she does, and she bounces right back.
Yeah, she does. Had anyone had any sort of similar situation like that happen to you with your parent?
Oh, I actually do. It wasn't that bad. Okay, so this is my junior year, and I went to senior prom. I was a junior, and I went to senior prom. I know. Cool guy. So I was went to senior prom with friends, my senior friends, and it was probably like past 10 o'clock. And we weren't doing anything. I think we were just like at a Denny's getting food after prom. But I remember my mom wanted me home early, and she kept calling my phone. I didn't pick up because I was out having fun. I was just having fun with friends, Mom. But I remember when I was getting dropped off in front of my house, my mom was outside waiting for me.
Oh, no.
And then so she walked up to my friend's car and yelled at me in front of my friend and, you know, was like, "You're home too late," and blah, 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 and just kind of embarrassed me. And I was, yeah.
Okay. Maybe I shouldn't share my story then because mine is extreme. Okay. So it was summer school and I was talking to this guy on AOL Messenger.
Nice. ASL.
Do you guys remember AOL?
I remember that. Yes.
what was ASL?
ASL, age, sex, location. So what is it? What's the new kid? What's the kids do now? Is it WYD? Like, what you doing? Is that the new ASL? I don't know.
Oh yeah, I guess so. I didn't think about it like that. Yeah, it could be.
And so it was summer school, and I, you know, in between during the summer, whatever, I was talking to this guy, and he was not a guy. Okay, I was.
You thought he was a guy.
I was a freshman going into sophomore, and he was 2 years older than me. So yeah, he was a little bit older, but still within the parameters. Mm-hmm. He wanted to meet up, and so you know, I went to his house and mostly just played with his little sister, who was maybe 4 years younger. And then I left, and but I got home a little bit too late, so it was 5. And you know, summer school is normally over around 2. So what's wrong? Why wasn't I home already? And I thought I could make it, but my dad happened to just come home a little bit early, and he's like, "Where were you?" I was like, you know, I didn't want to tell him that I was at a guy's house. That would be way worse. So yeah. I did lie. I didn't. But he's like, "You were with a boy, weren't you?" And I was like, I don't remember exactly what I said, but he was so mortified that I came home so late that he drove me to urgent care because he was saying, "I want them to check to see if you're still a virgin." And I was "What?
Oh my gosh." The fuck?
So there was all this fucked upness about the fact that purity and bullshit.
Sure.
You know, he was trying to call my bluff, right?
Wow.
And there was I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to – I was 13 at that time. No, I wasn't – I didn't lose my virginity or anything like that. And so we just sat there, and it was I was maybe one or two away from them calling us. We sat there for 3 or 4 hours basically. And then my dad gets up and then leaves, and we leave. You know, so he was literally playing chicken with me. Okay, well, we're going to figure out if they're going to check you, going to check inside you and make sure you are. And it was no, but it was so not nearly as embarrassing as Ray's, I guess, but on the same, a whole other,
I don't know. I felt
other
level. Yours is
a different angle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad I went first and I didn't have to follow yours.
Yeah. You're like, no, it was fine. No. Yeah, exactly. I didn't have anything.
Mine was just not staying out late, not being accused of losing my virginity.
I know. Oh my gosh.
I did get brought home from a party, and my dad picked up my sister and I from prom, so there was that.
Oh my gosh, I'm getting embarrassed thinking about that.
It's interesting. That's what you guys talked about is interesting to me because the ways in which sexual purity or relationships between young men and young women among, I think, Asian Americans is an interesting conversation. We don't see it that often on the screen. You know, and when we do, it's often seen through this lens of extreme awkwardness or, you know, and this was such a natural and normal way of depicting it in Turning Red. Mm-hmm. And I think there is that angle of how we relate to our families and what do they think of us when we imagine ourselves as, you know, potentially sexual beings, right?
Right.
I want to go to our Love It, Leave It segment. I'll start. I love Abby. She's the best character. She doesn't say much, but she makes the most of her actions. She's definitely the lightning rod of the bunch that sparks the group. My favorite part is when she asks May to turn into the red panda, and then she like runs up to her and like pushes her face against the belly and just snuggles with her. She's freaking hilarious. Whoever wrote that character, whoever came up with Abby is a genius. She only obviously had the one big misstep when she read the wrong date of the Four Town concert.
Toledo, Ohio. Right.
You're so what's cute.
You know what? That's a fair mistake. You know, if I was to glance over that Toronto, I could see why she made that mistake. But you know what? It all worked out.
I have
out
the same question though. What is a Toledo? I love when Abby Toledo. I love when May asks Abby, punch me. And then she points to her arm and Abby just
punches
just gets her. It's just like right in the face. I was like, oh my God, I love her.
Yeah,
she's so aggressive at the same time.
Yes, my little girl. Gremlin, I love her so much.
My leave it. Okay, so I know that there's reasons for this, but I sort of didn't like how Ming, the mom, was kind of painted at the end in the stadium. Mm. They kind of made her as like this big, big, bad red panda. Like she was the worst of all of them. Like I don't know why she was so massive. And I felt the whole scene showed little compassion, understanding the pressure that Ming was probably under with, you know, her relationship with her mom and also raising May and all that stuff. Yes, Ming was the overbearing mother most of us can relate to, but it just didn't paint her in a very fair light, I thought. I think it was just borderline that she was the tiger mom, like for no reason.
Okay. That's interesting because I felt like it was like a very good step in like sci-fi. Like they had to have a kaiju. Why not?
Yes.
To bring in. Yes, I was okay with it. But okay, so I'll go next then. My love it is actually the 7 to 8 minutes of May just shaking her butt at her big bad Ming panda mom. Just like in every angle and every scene. It was like, you know, they had different people and she's still shaking her butt. And I just cracked up so bad, mostly because my youngest was also just cracking up for like the entire time too. And every time you watch it.
Was she shaking her butt to you?
Actually, it was me. It's me shaking my butt. And she hates it. She hates it. She's like, no, she wants to hit it and stuff. But yeah, so, but we shake it together at that point. Cause normally she doesn't like the gyrating, but yeah.
the gyrating was hilarious.
So that's definitely my love it. My leave it. It has to be that they only gave the dad like one really good, dialogue piece, but why only one? He was so amazing. I would love to see a spinoff where, like, you know, where dad, you know, gets way more lines. But anyway, that was definitely my leave it. He was really strong. I wish they could have given him more.
I like that. I'm going to riff off of that because I felt similarly about that situation too. I liked the giant red panda that May's mom became, and I liked her because it spoke strength to me, said like, look how much she was willing to like set aside, and in the moment in which we kind of talk about. They're in that sort of astral space where she's grieving for having hurt her own mother. And the weight of her guilt was just so intense and so immense that she just kind of repressed all of who she was. So like all this force of life that she had so much life to give, and yet she held all of it in for the sake of tradition and her daughter and her mother and things like that. There was a whole lot of that. So I kind of enjoyed, you know, giant kaiju. Kaiju Ming.
I mean, the way that you explained it, Saba, if they could convey that in the movie, then I would have been like, oh, but okay.
That is absolutely it. That, you know, they show that in multiple different ways. And I love the way they do that because it is a repression of who we are and who we want to be. And it's like, you know, and that's the whole point of Mei Lin's journey is about unleashing the panda, but also within parameters, right? It's not always something that you should just go to immediately. it's that balance. So yeah.
But that whole space, the scene in which we're seeing the warrior spirit, the panda spirit, that sort of astral world. I love that. That was like, I think probably my favorite. I mean, of course it's mythology. It's, you know, that's a space that I absolutely adore. So I love that about it. And I love how that paired with this beautiful inclusivity through the whole movie. There was so much diversity. Like, you could find someone who somehow connects to you, even South Asian goths. I mean, like, yes. You can find everything, right? And, I was talking to my niece about this, and she's like, there's even a girl wearing a hijab over here. And, you have so much more diversity center stage. And it works really well because it's kind of held in this sort of matrix of this other world that we're looking at, where there's so much potential and possibility. So it feels hopeful rather than like a caricature to me. So I really enjoyed that. There's really nothing that I would say, oh, take this out. But there were a couple of things I wish I could have seen developed a little bit more. And that's like the father. I wish we had a little bit more of the father because he was such a supportive dad. Yeah. And even like the grandfather who was describing
the shaman.
The shaman, that's who he was. I liked him too. And I felt like we just had such a tiny little bit of the ants. They were hilarious, you know? They were hilarious. But I wanted more of that, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard because then, you know, how much longer is the movie going to be, right?
It's going to be a 3-hour epic.
I know, right? I want to go back to your comment about inclusivity. I don't know if people even saw this, but like, or recognized it, but when Maylin is in the school bathroom and that girl walks out from the toilet stall, and as she's freaking out, Maylin, you know, puts her hand on her face and pushes her in. There's actually, she has a sticker on her arm, and that sticker is actually like a diabetic sticker so that you can be able to see. Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was really interesting. I know it just looked like maybe just like a decoration, but even something that small as that representation is so amazing. And they have little bits of that kind of like throughout.
Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. As a longtime plant-based eater, Annie started this business to create a way for herself and others to enjoy the foods often shared with family but don't fit a plant-based diet. The journey started with vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes. Follow Annie's Tea Cakes on Instagram or go to annie'steacakes.com to place your order today.
One of the things that came up that Renee and I talked offline is the concept of a fursona.
Ooh.
So Renee, could you please explain to me, because I still don't know and I don't get it, and to our listeners, what a fursona is?
So fursona is a portmanteau of the word furry, which is a subset of fandom and persona. And that's how you get fursona, where it's supposed to represent your own personal character within the furry fandom. So here's the thing. Furries can range from bats to seals to tigers to the more mainstream furry fandom, bronies. And before you ask, yes, it can, but it is not specifically sexual in nature, Ray.
That's what I thought. I thought a fursona was like a furry fetish thing.
So it can, but it is not always. Do I know some people who put raccoon butt plugs in? Yes, but that is not everyone.
Strategically placed zippers.
Exactly. But that is not everyone. So the more mainstream and a little bit more approachable would be your bronies, where there are people who love My Little Pony. But I have some brony friends who don't actually dress up. So here's the thing. Actually, there was like this little study done or survey done. And it was saying something along the lines of that only about 40% of furries actually even own any furry regalia. Many people actually don't. The closest things, the quickest, easiest things to go towards, of course, are little tails or little furry ears. But otherwise, most furries actually don't. They do have furry cons where you can be able to be dressed up. but they cost hundreds of thousands and sometimes even thousands of dollars to actually create. There are some people who make, you know, you can go to make them, but also it's just like, you know, for an example, people say it, and maybe the term itself is a little bit, what is it called? Appropriation, but like your spirit animal is sure. something that you can be able to say, right? So instead of saying spirit animal, maybe the more PC term to use is what's your fursona.
Okay. So you can live a furry lifestyle, but not actually have any furry like memorabilia.
Yes, you can.
Okay. So what about this lifestyle? Is it more of just like you're into furry animals?
You like animals, you know, like, and it's a spectrum, right? It's a spectrum of how much you like that animal. And sometimes you change. Like I have a friend who like identifies as a tiger, you know, like that kind of thing. So.
And what kind of personality trait does a furry tiger have?
You'll have to ask them.
So what's your fursona, Renee?
I want to turn it to you guys since I went ahead and defined it, right? What's your fursona?
So I'm taking a BuzzFeed quiz right now, but go ahead, Saba.
Okay, so what animal would I, you know, what would be my red panda?
Yes.
I like animals and I like all kinds of animals. And I think it'd be really hard to pick one, but it would have to be some kind of cat. Some like a lion.
Oh yeah,
you know. Yeah, a lion. Not gonna say tiger because you had a tiger there just now. But you know, maybe a lion. I'll go there because you know they are independent and they're vicious when they're provoked, but most of the time they're just purring and like going about their business.
Yeah, exactly. So, they're still just big cats. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So according to BuzzFeed, the quiz is titled "Which Unique Fursona Should You Have?" I got the armadillo.
What? That's awesome. Oh my yeah. God.
The armadillo, it says, you're awkward and goofy, but everyone loves you for it.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Okay. So while I do have a big tiger tattoo, and I would say normally I would say like my fursona is tiger, I'm going to go ahead and say growing up, my favorite animal was the dolphin. So my fursona doesn't have fur per se. But I definitely think it's a dolphin because, you know, sleek, elegant, fast, and could fucking kill a shark. You know, don't mess with me. But also just like really weird, goofy, social, and loves to do tricks. Wait, no, not like that though.
Nice.
Whoa, so what kind of tricks are we talking here? Freaky tricks or like trick tricks? You know.
Moving on.
Okay. So we have our fursona. Let's go into our Four Town member. Renee, who's your favorite Four Town member?
I gotta go with Robert. I mean, he's just elegant. He speaks French and you know, he's the dad to Robert Jr. So, you know, I just gotta
Right.
So Robert's my favorite. There you go.
I feel like they all kind of blend together for me. I like all of them with their wings
Aaron
on.
Aaron and Aaron.
With their wings on specifically.
Oh, yes.
So I'll take them all in that moment.
I feel like there wasn't that much of a highlight on Fort Town, but if I had to pick one, I'll pick Jesse.
I was going to say Jesse.
Yeah, as the oldest member. Father figure, I'm assuming. Yeah, Jesse's kind of like 24. The de facto leader, which is
no,
the
it's
oldest
Robert.
Member.
Robert's the leader.
Robert's yeah. the leader?
Oh. He's the leader. Okay, but he's the lead singer.
Okay, but see, Robert is the front-facing leader. Jesse is the guy that actually holds the it down.
He's, the,
he's sure. the one in the back pulling the strings. That's right. When they're
exactly.
up in the...
Exactly.
When
he's
they're
the
as, with their wings on, he's the one who's pulling them. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, he's got kids and a family, so he's quite mature, and he's the one who's kind of keeping the group together. Jesse's always controlling the circus of fame between the group, making sure everyone shows up to practice on time, making sure they make call time on spot, making sure
okay,
they're hitting their
right.
marks,
all right. Okay,
the,
all right.
the choreo, and they're yelling. He's always like, Tae Young, left kickball chain. You're missing your mark. 5, 6, 7, 8. Do it again. Oh, that's Jesse right there. Again.
This is no longer just Ray's headcanon. This is canon.
I agree.
I'm projecting.
Next time I watch this, I'm going to see that happening going on
That's
over
there. That's exactly it. Do you know that Jesse is actually voiced by Phineas? Billie Eilish's brother. Yeah. Oh. So he sings and, yeah, he does the voice for Jesse.
So I know that they have the big song in the movie. Do they have any other songs? I didn't really hear.
There's three songs. Yeah, there's three songs. Oh,
okay. I remember two, but yeah, three sounds right.
So, Four Town has three songs that are in the movie itself. They are actually all three of them are written by Billie Eilish and her older brother Phineas. Oh. And yeah, and the songs are the number one song that everyone knows is Nobody Like You, with the letter U. There's You Know What's Up, right? And that one also plays at the ending credits. And then there's the soft, you know, anthem one, where it's just the one true love. And that's the one that you hear when it's like the mermaid, when they show like the 3D version of the mermaid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, the dream one. Yes, exactly. So those are the three songs.
Here's what's going to happen to the group. One of them's going to pick up a really bad coke habit and just fall into this downward spiral of doing crazy drugs and partying in Vegas all the time. God. And then the other one, like another band member, is going to be Tae Young, who's going to knock up a fan
and going to
claim, you know, she wants full custody and he has to like take care of the child. And then Aaron T is going to run away and like completely ghost the group, start his own solo career. But then here's
Someone's
the thing after,
a solo career.
And then they're going to be on VH1's Behind the Music and kind of go through this whole drama. Like 5 years later, they're going to have like a reunion tour, see? And then they're all going to come back together and they're going to go on this international tour and they're just going to make lots of money.
Awesome. There's that. Yeah, I'm sure. Here's the thing. Aaron Z actually never left the business and he became a judge for a voice competition reality TV show.
Oh, yeah. Aaron will stay in show business. He'll stay in show business. He's the one who's always going to stay famous. But definitely two out of the five are going to pick up drug habits, I have to say. One's is going to be cocaine, and the other one is going to be painkillers or like ivermectin or something. Oh, and then another one is going to be, I think, and then another one's going to become a QAnon conspiracy theorist. He's going to fall down this really bad rabbit hole, start believing it, start listening to conspiracy theories and start telling like super conservative Trump supporter that's going to be one of the members. And be like, and everyone's going to be like, what happened to that guy? What happened to Robert? What happened?
Robert, you know for sure.
He's got the signs.
Okay, then really quickly. Who is your boy band? Who's your boy band?
Oh,
Backstreet
oh,
Boys, okay. NSYNC, O-Town, 98 Degrees, you know, New Kids on the Block?
Block, for sure. Oh. That is what was around when I was young. So, yep.
I would count Boyz II Men as a boy band, but I know that sure. They're not in the same kind of genre. They're right. On the upper echelon of boy bands. But if we're limiting it to just, you know, bubblegum white boys, then I would say I'm team Backstreet Boys for sure.
Nice.
Oh my God, I was going to say that too. I was.
Here's my take about it, because it's really only Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. Every other group are just wannabes. Let's just face it. Like O-Town had one hit.
New Kids on the Block. Put some respect on that name.
Yes.
They're kind of there, okay? 98 the Degrees original. Are kind of there. Really?
Didn't they do like a reunion tour recently?
Oh,
they're
constantly on reunion.
Oh, are they?
For sure.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I'm telling you right now, every year in the Super Bowl, AFC, NFC, the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, they're the only two competitors. They're the real two competitors. But here's the thing. I think Backstreet Boys have better singers, vocalists from a pure talent standpoint, but NSYNC has more of the hits. They're definitely much more equipped for the pop genre.
Wasn't a One Direction like really big too? I feel like a lot of my cousins were into.
That's definitely more the 2000s, right? I definitely feel like we're like there's compartments of different sagas of. I mean, like you could even say Jackson 5 were boy band, you know.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. Any Motown guys, you know, Temptations and whatnot. But no, wow. Yeah, exactly. I know I'm going way back.
Okay. We're gonna close this out with I'm gonna bring us all back to the movie. That was a fun conversation, but we'll take it on a slightly serious note. As you know, we usually do in this podcast, we kind of bring it to the real world, talk about what's kind of trending about this movie. Generally, I thought Turning Red got really good reviews, but one of the things that is talked about, especially amongst Asian American media and Asian American community, was that there was this one review by Cinema Blend's Sean O'Connell who kind of gave it a somewhat negative review. I don't think he destroyed or said that it was a terrible movie, but this is an excerpt from his review. By rooting Turning Red very specifically in the Asian community of Toronto, the film legitimately feels like it was made for Domi Shi's friends and immediate family members, which is fine, but also tad limiting in its scope. So basically he's saying that the film didn't resonate with him being a white man and that it's limited in scope. And before I get your guys' response, Domi did have a response to the review. She said, "Was his puberty not exhausting? Lucky man." So who wants to go first to comment on Sean O'Connell's review or just the whole situation itself?
Okay, I'll go ahead and go first. I think it's exhausting to have to respond to things like this, but okay, let's go ahead and go. I think one of the biggest turnoffs definitely is that if you don't feel like you're in on the jokes, it makes you feel like you're an outsider. That's mm-hmm. fine, right? Mm-hmm. And that's fine, you know. Not every film is something that's made for everyone. I don't think that's how it should work either. But to also say that it's a limiting in scope, I mean, like, every person has to go through puberty, you know? Sometimes some people go through it multiple times, even, especially for those who are, like, in the trans community, who maybe went through their life and then transitioned, right? And then you're going through it again. So it's just, like, I feel like there's absolutely this disconnect when you have reviewers who just don't want to go the extra mile to kind of, not even the extra mile, but just like don't want to see the humanity in things. And I think that's almost, I wouldn't tip the hand as that far to say that that's the case, but also at the same time, it's like, you know what, take reviews with a grain of salt, just like award ceremonies and things like that. You know, mm-hmm. getting awards doesn't mean that you are more or less valid, you know? And I think that's one of the things too here. It's just like, if you enjoyed it, you enjoy it. Great. If you don't, you know, move on. That's just my salty take. Sorry.
Salty, slightly sprinkle of salt.
I'll be just as salty. I'll throw some bitterness in there too. You know, I think that the film makes very clear that it's not talking about periods, right? They make very distinct, like there's a whole conversation about the mother showing up at this school and talking about May's potential period and then discovering that it's the red panda. We see that, yes, it's about puberty, but it's also about emotional development mm-hmm. and about self-empowerment and a sense of owning your own power in a space where you're not necessarily allowed to express yourself. So a person who chooses to see that as extremely limiting strikes me as a person who may not really be thinking about what it's like to have to limit your own sense of self-expression when it comes to power.
Oh, snap.
This is deeply problematic. Many people are disempowered in terms of their voices, in terms of their representation, in terms of their ability to just be themselves. And to say, oh, this is just like you and your friends, that's like saying you and your friends don't count, only what I think counts. Oh. I mean, that's a moment for that reviewer to really reflect upon what kind of message that they're sending about who gets to choose agency and who gets to determine what self-empowerment means and in what way.
Mm-hmm. Mike, drop.
Just to add on to the situation. So when the review came out, obviously social media and a lot of people in the Asian American community mm-hmm. made a...
We dogpiled Sean O'Connell.
Dogpiled yes. On top of it, basically. And the consensus, the general consensus of it was, you know, obviously him being a white man, a lot of people were like, well, now just because you're looking at it from a white male gaze, you're centralizing, you thinking that every movie has to relate to white men mm-hmm. or you as a white man. So he worked for Cinema Blend, and I believe his review was taken down, or Cinema Blend took down his review. Mm-hmm. And he apologized on Twitter, of course, he had to apologize, basically admitting that he was wrong and sorry, I said it was hurtful and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people were just like, yeah, it's, you know, what you said was perpetuating harmful, problematic, all those buzzwords and all that stuff. But just wanted to add that context on there as well.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, every movie has an audience. You can't make a movie for all people and expect everyone to love it. You know, if you're trying to reach every single person, you're not going to hit anyone. You know, you're not going to reach anyone. So politicizing that sort of targeted direction, I think I'm glad someone held that reviewer to account and held that person to task.
Yeah.
So I've given this some thought. Okay, first of all, Sean's review is dead wrong. Let's start with that. It doesn't relate to him, but that doesn't mean the movie's resonance is limited in scope. Mm-hmm. To him, I would ask him, like, are you the barometer of whether a movie relates to you or not? Are you the standard? Like, does every movie have to relate to you? How do you even know this movie is limited in scope and doesn't relate to whoever it is that you're assuming? So in that case, he's dead wrong. But here's where I somewhat have an issue with this whole situation, is that he apologized for the review. Because to me, it's kind of like, what for? You're a critic, and your job is to critique films. And just because you're flat wrong in this instance doesn't mean you should apologize for doing your job. If he wants to admit that his review was wrong or maybe unfair, that's fine. That's up to his, you know, that's maybe in a sense of taking accountability, but don't apologize, because if you're a critic and you need to apologize every time you offend someone, whether it be the audience or the filmmaker or the actors, whatever the case may be, then you shouldn't be a critic. It's as simple as that. Because at the end of the day, it's one review against many other positive remarks for the movie. And so I do feel that he caught the firestorm, he caught the mob mentality, and then felt like, and also, you know, shame on Cinema Blend for not, I mean, they didn't have to stick up for Sean, but to take his review down. If I was Sean, I would be like, okay, well, now I have to be extra careful. I mean, he should be somewhat careful, but at the end of the day, he didn't really hurt anyone. He was just really, he just wrote a bad review. And I think it's okay for us to disagree. And it's somewhat what you said, Renee, is that we should all take reviews with like a grain of salt. But I didn't think that he needed to apologize.
Well, okay. Mm. I mean, I think if he said something that was just really, really wrong, hateful, harmful in any way, and stereotypical, things like that, then if it's a place where he can be able to learn from it and be held accountable, I think it's fine to apologize, but mean it. But when it's a hollow apology and you're saying it so that you can keep doing your job and you're like, hey, I did this thing. Okay, fine. Like, let's move on. Then that's the wrong approach to take it. Right. I agree that he should be able to have his wrong opinion. That's fine. And the mob pile on is probably not necessarily something that I think is like the best. Right. I think there are definitely times when to use it as a tool, but I don't think we need to bludgeon people just for having an opinion all the time. I think it should be measured, and there are definitely people who deserve to, but not for every single thing, you know, just because I don't like what you said.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that he should not have gotten, you know, the shitstorm thrown at him. I think that's totally fine. You know, if you are going to write a piece or put anything out there, you're automatically accepting you're accepting the parameters that you're going to be, your review is going to be reviewed as we are doing right now in this instance, in this episode. But for you to take it back, I think it just sets a very dangerous precedent. It's like, you know, what's your job then? I mean, you have, like, you're a critic. Like, you should be able to stand up and say, like, okay, well, my review was wrong and I got shit for it, but don't apologize and don't take it down. I think taking it down is just not a good precedent to set.
I agree with that too, because I think that, like, you know, he wasn't going out of his way to be hateful or offensive.
Yeah, and I've read the review. Like, it wasn't anything where he's like, the hell's this Asian shit?
Right.
He was just,
just short-sighted, right? Just short-sighted.
Yeah, it was just very short-sighted, very myopic, yeah.
And so maybe he should have had an opportunity to address it, to revise his opinion, to think about it. But I don't think it should have been removed, because I think it's part of the discussion.
Right,
and I don't think a sorry or an apology does much. I think it was a missed opportunity for productive dialogue to remove that from circulation.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Alrighty. I then want to thank again Saba and Renee for jumping on this pod. I just want to say Fort Town forever. We put your little fingers in the...
Fort Town forever.
Fort Town forever. Tune in next time for another episode of Real Asian Podcast. Take care, y'all. Bye.